Hello and welcome to this special episode of the Uber Brands podcast in which we turn the tables, meaning that Patrick Brigger, who is co-founder and chairman of Get Abstract, will actually interview me.
JP Kilwine, a recognized global brand builder and co-author of Rethinking Prestige Branding.
About Uber Brands. Now, Get Abstract is a provider of what they call compressed knowledge. You might know them from their popular business book summaries, but they have a whole host of business and self-improvement information. You might want to check them out at getabstract.com. In this interview, Patrick asked me about the principles of Uber branding, how these brands have come to dominate the redefined prestige brand space, the broader brand space in general, how they change people's perceptions, how people can be Uber brands themselves, and how they attract people not only to buy them, but also work for them. I hope you enjoy this special edition. If you like the podcast, then please show it by giving us some star ratings on your podcast player and forwarding the link to your friends. That is what keeps us going. And if you have any questions or need our help in elevating your own brand to Uber brand status, then just write to us at info@uberbrands.com, and that's spelled with a U-E as it should be. And now, enjoy.
Please listen carefully.
Hi, JP. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Thanks for having me.
And before we start, I would like to ask you if you could share moments in your life that have helped you in your professional career.
Okay. Maybe let me talk about a moment of branding insight, since we're on that subject. The power of branding came to me when I started with Procter & Gamble in Cincinnati in the mid-90s. Now I'm aging myself. And one of the things that surprised me as a European there in all the meetings was there were a lot of soft drinks, always, you know, Coca-Cola and the others on the table, but there was never any water. And I was used to that from, you know, Germany back home. And when I asked people about, can we have some water, they were looking at me a little bit strangely because they said, water, just go outside in the corridor, there's a fountain. So the habit in the US was, you know, water was for free, it's a total commodity. And if you want to drink water, you drink it on water fountain. Fast forward to today, and I just spent a whopping $9 on a bottle of water yesterday at a bar when I met up with somebody. Mm-hmm. And I keep being surprised about the change and the power branding has achieved in this commodity segment of water. Now, all of a sudden, not only do you pay for water, but you pay more for water than you do for soft drinks. And you're very picky. Would you like San Pellegrino? No, I prefer Badoit, or I want a still water and I don't want it too sparkling. So it's incredible the power of branding and how it can change perceptions, habits, rituals, etc., which is part of the inspiration for why I am in this business.
Okay, interesting. So, you know, the way that commodity products have changed because of different brandings have actually shaped what you do in your professional career and gave you inspiration.
Absolutely.
So, JP, you and Wolfgang Schaffer, you have written a book, Rethinking Prestige Branding, The Secrets of the Uber Brand. Now, what is Uber branding? It's not a typical English word, is it? And I'm assuming it has no affiliation to the Uber car service.
Absolutely. It's not about taxi services. And you're one of the very few interviewers who actually knows how to pronounce Uber, because you're from a German-speaking background. Uber is obviously German. In English, it would translate to something like above and beyond. And philosopher Nietzsche was talking about Uber people, Übermenschen, and he was talking about them in the context of people who bring humanity forward, whether it's in science, philosophy, the arts, you name it. People who aspire to do more than the daily routine and somehow nudge us forward. And what we found when Wolfgang and I studied these modern prestige brands, these brands that are able to make themselves priceless, or at least a little bit priceless, these brands succeed in being more than the utilitarian benefit of their product, i.e. they're more than a handbag, than a cup of water, than a sweater, than a car. They aspire to also bring humanity forward, whether it's in thought, whether it's in art, whether it's in craft, social issues, you name it. And so when we saw this parallel, we thought, why don't we annoy all these English speakers a little bit and create some myth also by using the German name Uber, which is impossible to pronounce. So every time I get introduced to a client or at a speech, people would say, well, it's Uber, but you have to explain it to us, which is exactly what I want to do.
Okay. So these Uber brands want to bring humanity forward. But I imagine a traditional classic, let's start with the luxury brands. They also would like to bring humanity forward. So what makes these modern prestige Uber brands different from these classic brands?
Well, actually, two things, because they're different from the classic luxury in that a lot of classic luxury focused on what I call the big P's, which are precious materials, provenance, i.e., you know, I have a long history, I've got a tradition, price, of course, and the exclusivity that comes with it, i.e. I'm so expensive, only the rich can anyway consider to buy me. And that lent them the prestige and the admiration. You know, a Rolls Royce is not for everyone. Mm. Modern prestige brands might still be pricey. For sure, they're more expensive than the average good in their category, but it's not necessarily about the absolute price and precious material. So for example, Aesop, which is a beauty brand from Australia, does have pricey hand soaps. They cost about 40 to 60 euros for a bottle of hand soap. In the market, that can be had for as little as 4 euros, okay? So 10 times or more. However, it's not classic luxury. It's not about being in a golden bottle. It's not about being from France and, you know, somehow having the grapes of Chateau Lafite in it. It's all about exquisite sophistication, about thought, about philosophy, about being brainy beauty, as we call it, and beautiful minimalist modern design that is not necessarily expensive, but inspirational. So modern luxury, modern prestige, Uber brands create their exclusivity as much around knowledge as they do it around gold and bling.
And in the book, Rethinking Prestige Branding, you introduce 7 principles, how premium brands seduce with the truth of their products. So some of it, which you just said, but can you tell us a little bit more about these 7 principles?
Right. How much time do you have? No. Let me talk about 3 big picture dimensions that we work out in the book. We call them mission, myth, and truth. Mm-hmm. Mission is, as I explained a little bit already, these brands are more than just a utilitarian benefit. So you will find that they aspire to do something that is bigger. Let's take Patagonia, okay? Mm-hmm. It's not really luxury again, but pretty expensive sweaters when you compare it to the average. Patagonia is, of course, about outdoor gear, but it's also about protecting that environment that you explore with their fashions and equipment. So they take on very specifically and very adamantly and as an activist causes to protect the environment, to build back dams, to recycle things versus throwing them away, etc., etc. So they have a mission, and with that mission, they create meaning that is bigger than their goods. And with that, they let us not only buy an object and stuff that maybe later we throw away. On the contrary, they let us buy into something, into a philosophy, into an ideology. Think about Ben and Jerry's and social justice. So that's one big difference. Mission. Myth is all about storytelling. And a lot of brands and people do a good job at telling their story by now, because everyone understands stories are what is memorable and you know what people will tell other people. So it creates word of mouth. However, myths are kind of the Uber stories, to use that word again, because myths have been told endlessly from the pharaohs and Chinese to, you know, the Greek and the Romans, because they eternally preoccupy us and we eternally have these questions. Questions that science cannot answer, like what happens at the end of life, what is there at the end of the earth, the universe, the galaxy, depending on which time period we're in. Myths try to answer these questions and guide us. And so if you're able to link your brand to a myth, it will be stronger for it. An example would be Mini, which is not just a car, but it's that little car that could or can, that bulldog, British car. It's the quintessential David versus Goliath myth. And in the US, for example, it's being loved for being a small car that fights against the SUV. Okay. So that is myth. And then finally, and very important difference, is truth. Truth means you really manifest your brand. You don't just talk about, let's say, recycling, but you come from Switzerland. You're the Freitag brand, and I go to Zurich, and I can go to your not only shop, but to your plant, the place you make your bags, and I can see that you practice recycling, not only in your manufacturing, but even in your office, and even how your people talk about it. Mm-hmm. And it's the same when you go to Ben & Jerry's in Vermont. And it's the same when you go to an espresso club. It is living the suave sophistication of a George Clooney in every one of their clubs. So they create their truth 360 degree. Those are some of the key elements of Uber brands.
Okay, that makes sense. And it's probably a good thing for any company to think about mission, myth, and truth to incorporate. Now, JP, Generation Y and Generation Z, the teenagers and young adults, they represent an estimated 200 billion in annual global purchasing power. How important are they for Uber brands? And in what sense, and especially for Uber brands, do they influence and manipulate the consumer behavior of these people?
Yes, yes, and yes. So they are very important. But I want to tell you in a second that they're really not much different from previous generation either. So we need to keep that in mind. And yes, absolutely, they influence the market, and that's why they are so important. Right now, the millennials are actually not so important when you are very high priced, good and in luxury on the top end, because they don't have much money. Mm. And that they share with previous generations. If they have much money, it's because of their rich parents. And yes, then they might still go to Hermes. But overall, it's the baby boomers still that spend the majority of the absolute money. But of course, like every young generation, the millennials set the tone in terms of what's hip, what's fashionable, and what us old people who want to stay young and fashionable will replicate. Okay, so if they like Supreme, then eventually LVMH works with that skateboard company Supreme to also stay hip and relevant. So in that sense, they are trendsetters. And of course, they are digital natives and they know how social media work from birth. And so they show us a trick or two and they develop the platforms like Snapchat or whatever that pop up that become very important tools for marketing. And then finally, they also are what we call the potential brand disciples, the people, the Uber target, who spreads the word about a brand and is actually much more impactful in convincing people that it's a good brand than a formal or traditional piece of advertising might be. So in that sense, yes, they're super important. However, I also don't like people get too panicked all the time about the millennials saying, oh my God, they prefer experiences over goods. They are not loyal to brands and switch around all the time. They stay with small price points, because really, really, that's no different from youth in any other generation. In fact, I would argue that if you were the young generation in the 60s and you went off to India for 6 months to join an ashram, it was much more difficult for brands to get a hold of you, connect with you, and make you spend money than it is with today's millennials, who might jet off to Iceland but are still on their smartphone and receive your advertising messages.
Mm-hmm. I imagine that the social media channels are important, or what's the importance or not importance of those channels for the Uber branding?
Particularly luxury brands, but many brands in general were struggling with social media because at the beginning it seemed like too mundane, too much schoolyard, literally, because a lot of the conversations that used to happen in the schoolyard, you know, like, oh, look at my cat, or, you know, look at my lipstick or whatever, the chatter now landed on the internet. And so brands were saying, wow, I'm not sure I want to participate in these kind of low level conversations. But now I think generally people have recognized that social media are simply one more very human, very natural, very attractive way of conversation, just like phone calls and other things. And it has turned itself around, really, where now brands are eager to participate in the human conversation in pop culture, in culture in general. And so social media have become a key ingredient to spread the word of mouth, to authenticate your brand as popular, etc., etc.
And now an Uber brand can be very influential, especially for younger people. You know, think about a soft drink or even maybe cigarettes, I'm assuming can be something like this. So does a brand also carry some type of a social responsibility as well to shape people?
Absolutely. In fact, that is one of the differentiators that I pointed out earlier. Mm-hmm. Now, depending obviously where you are on the moral, political, religious, you name it spectrum, you will like one or the other Uber brand. They're not for everyone, mm-hmm. and everyone has their own, which is part of what makes them special. But what will differentiate an Uber brand is that they have a mission and they firmly believe in it, and they're transparent about it and authenticated by manifesting it. So, for example, Ben & Jerry's is a good tasting ice cream. It's fun. It hands out free cones. But from a political perspective, it consistently sides with what Americans would describe as the more liberal causes. It goes with the 99%, if you remember Occupy Wall Street. Ben & Jerry's actually got arrested in Washington several times, including protesting against Trump as a candidate. And Ben & Jerry's put that on their website. Now, on other mass-focused brands that are trying to hide what they truly are, and just put a marketing facade forward, something like this would be a PR issue. Imagine your founders being arrested for political reason. Mm-hmm. Imagine somebody in your brand actively participating in demonstrations for one cause or another. It doesn't matter whether conservative or liberal. But these brands, they stand by their beliefs. They make them very clear. They're very outspoken about them. And then you, as a consumer, judge whether you love them or often you hate them. But they're so much more stronger for it. So you might love the attitude of a Patagonia saying, I want to protect the environment, I want to build back dams. Or you might not believe in that and say, oh, I didn't even realize Patagonia was about that. In the future, I will no longer buy their brand.
And probably this authentic behavior is also interesting or attracting for employees as well. If you identify with what the company doing, you love what you do and you're part of that environment.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I've heard personally stories when we researched for our book, you know, over 100 case studies, which was a lot of fun. I heard personal stories about people camping out in the winter, for example, in Austria, in front of Red Bull to get attention by the organization and behind. And then later, the same thing, somebody came, and one of our most favorite popular case studies is about Aesop. And he said, I read your case study. I'm so inspired. I'm flying to Australia and I will seek employment. And I said, well, did you talk to them before? No, they have never responded to my emails. But I'm thinking if I just stand in front of their door, they will end up talking to me. So, yes, very strong attraction also for employees because of the consistency. Mm-hmm. When you go to Freitag in Zurich, people really talk the Freitag talk, not because they learned it by heart or it's the, you know, company strategy that they have all aligned to, but because they really feel that way about the environment, about recycling, etc.
Yeah, I have been in their building. We have seen that, and that's absolutely true what you're saying. So, JP, this Überbrand principle, is it possible to apply to more generic goods as well, like salt or, I don't know, motor oil?
Absolutely. In fact, a favorite podcast, I also do podcasts, so sometimes I do it the other way around. I'm the interviewer, and one of my favorite ones is with a CEO, Mr. Da Silva from Portugal, who has a toilet paper brand, Renova. And one line extension of the brand is, I want to call it artistic, beautiful toilet paper. In his words, you know, he said, if I can make life, which is tough enough, a little bit more fun, and I put the smile on somebody, and it happens to be when they use their toilet paper, then I feel great about my job. Now, this gentleman is a nuclear scientist, believe it or not, who worked at CERN, and he decided in the end to make toilet paper because he loved the people and he loved this idea of creating happiness with small things, and he loved the idea of doing incredibly artistic and innovative things with something as mundane, I should say, as a toilet paper. So the long-winded answer is absolutely yes. In fact, if you're a salt, a water, or a toilet paper, you need it even more because you're in a totally commoditized marketplace. And unless you're the super big manufacturer of salt, you need to find a different twist, like Celle de la Guérande, okay, in order to survive in that market.
Okay. And could it be possible to apply the concept to a company, not the end product, but the company itself?
Again, absolutely yes. In fact, when we started to consult on the subject, because brands came to us and said, hey, I want to become an Uber brand. How do I do that? One of my biggest surprises was a lot of business-to-business companies and manufacturers of ingredients coming to us rather than just, you know, consumer-focused CPG brands or lifestyle brands and others. And in the end, working with them, you find that buyers of industrial goods are just as much humans as everyone else, and that the brand standing for something more than being an industrial good, let's say a locomotive, and I take a real example here, is also important to them. Short story, maker of locomotives, and they work together with a TV channel and with a publisher to show the great exploration and history of locomotives and the railway in America. And with that, their brand of locomotives becomes incredibly emotional, even for children who love these stories about how to engineer locomotives and how they went even through the craziest nature and most beautiful nature and difficult nature in America. Now, all of a sudden, their stand at trade fairs, locomotive and industrial good trade fairs, are being swamped by buyers and their children to get autographs, to get pictures, to get posters. This brand, you know, feels great about the impact it has to be loved versus just bought on pure rational specifications.
Okay, I have two more questions. I mean, when we listen to you, I think everybody, at least me, I'd love to have a Uber brand. It makes sense, and I think it's more advantages to have. Are there occasions where you say it doesn't make sense, just stay with what you do? And if you do like would like to become an Uber brand, where should I start? What are the some action steps?
All right. Well, people can be Uber brands as well, and think of Elon Musk or, you know, Turi Birch or, I don't know, Barack Obama, Beyonce, you know, a lot of people are obviously Uber brands. And when you look at what has gotten them there, it is often that they dream big, have a strong mission, and then really pursue this with a lot of intent and are not afraid to start small, but to consistently do this in terms of growth versus making one big splash, one big venture capital funded investment. And if that doesn't work, they cut it after a year or two and they don't continue. On the contrary, when we studied these brands, whether it's Nespresso, Aesop, Red Bull, you name it, it took them a long time to get where they are, but they've grown consistently since then. So where to start? I think the most important starting point is, do you have a mission that is meaningful, that is distinctive, that you find people can be passionate about. Not everyone. In fact, it's better if it's not everyone. But there needs to be a group. There needs to be an emerging current that you can participate in, that you can help guide, that you can fuel the conversation on. And then slowly build up the elements we talked about. Find your own language. Part of what makes Starbucks special is just the language. Venti skinny frappuccino. You know, what is that? They invented it. Or Maison du Chocolat uses its own language, which is the language of jewelry for their chocolates. So choose your own language. Choose your own manifestation. Like when you go into Maison du Chocolat, it's a jewelry store. It's not a chocolate store. And that's what makes it special. And stick with it and find allies. You will find that Tesla is much bigger than the little car production it does. It's still a tiny car manufacturer. But all the fans, the bloggers, the people who go crazy about this vision of the electric car and Elon Musk personality, they are the ones carrying the message and amplifying it and making it so much bigger. So, you know, do an audit, but it surely starts with the mission and then you slowly build it up.
Okay, I guess the good news is you don't have to have millions of venture capital money to become or to start to become a Uber brand. It's possible, like you say it, by going slowly and pursuing and being consistent.
Yesterday, I just talked to a little brand. They hand make jeans the way they used to be made. In fact, they use a lot of machinery from 1940 to 1970s. And when I asked them, you know, I said, you know, what's your end game? Do you want to be bought out? Do you want to exit in a big way via IPO? What is it? They said, we want to do the best jeans we can because we love that. That's where our heart is. And you know what? So far, we've been growing and growing steadily for the last 10 years. And their jeans, by the way, cost between $200 and $400 a pair. So it's not cheap. And good things come, they say, when you do it for the right reasons. So which shows again how the mission and the dedication to it is at the center. And it shows through the product, the service, and who you are.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, just saying, I want to make the best jeans. I imagine anybody producing anything will tell you, I want to make the best motor oil. I want to make the best paper. I want to make the best pens.
Absolutely. And then you go and you experience the difference. In fact, we had a conversation there, which is about in taste, there is an additional taste to sweet, sour, and so on, salty, which is called umami. And it's mysterious because you can't really describe it. It's a total mouth feel. It's the kind of, you know it when you've tasted it. Mm-hmm. And this founder talked about the same thing. He says, people go, they see our product, they feel our product, and they feel something's different. And if they want to, and those are the important Uber target, they go on the internet and they can see us on films that we shoot where we explain every buttonhole, every stitching, every seam. We treat in a special way. We take the loose threads and we put them under the seam. So versus industrially made jeans, you never have a loose thread. Every jean is especially fitted to really fit the particular model, and there's no variation. So people really pick it up intuitively. And then if they're interested, they can dig in deeper, very deep, because again, their factory is public. You can visit them and they will see why they had this special feeling about it. So that's also a very common thing that the manifestation and the passion comes through. And it's the most difficult thing for an industrial chocolate or jean or car or whatever it might be to do, because the worker on the line might not even get paid a lot. And their most important thing is just churn out as much as possible or go home as early as they can. And that's a different feeling that goes into making the product and talking about your own brand and company.
I will come back to the authenticity and that you not only say what you're doing, but you're actually doing it as well.
Absolutely. And you're doing it not because somebody told you to, but because
you love to do it. Yeah. Okay. We're almost at the end, JP. So I'd like to ask you one last question. I mean, you are surrounded with branding. You think about it. You live it all the time. How much is JP Coolwine affected by branding? Or another question is, what kind of socks are you wearing?
Excellent question. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I'm surrounded by them, and it's more diverse now than ever before. Yesterday, I worked at the same time on the branding of a building, actually a total building complex. So talk about branding parts of a city, urban branding. And on the other end of the spectrum, I was working for a client who is into telecommunications. So it's crazy. And I've developed almost a umami sense of branding, where I walk through the street now and I look at almost anything and say, you know, I wonder how they are thinking about the positioning of their brand. I wonder why I feel a certain way about it, whether there is this story that I'm feeling behind this brand, et cetera, et cetera. On the other hand, and I think it often happens for myself, I'm actually not very brand focused, except for a few things in my own buying and my own living. In fact, my own branding is rather shoddy. I have a podcast and a blog and a website, but I would consider them in no way an Uber brand, because my passion goes really into understanding Uber brands and helping other people to be one. When it comes to myself, I spend too little time on that. I absolutely recognize.
So you don't have to have some kind of a fancy sock brand on your feet?
I do have one fancy pair of socks that I reserve for special on TV or on stage appearances, just to have something to talk about. But usually I wear pretty mundane socks.
Okay, well, JP, thank you so much for your time and your tremendously interesting insights. It was a real pleasure talking to you, and many greetings to New York.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You'll find the summary of Rethinking Prestige Branding in your Get Abstract library.